I hereby introduce to you, Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. This is your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. So today is the second part of an interview with Mr. Will Tjernlund. Will is 25 and already has the wisdom of a man twice or three times his age in terms of entrepreneurial years. He is a master of Amazon, has sold $10 million of products in 3 years, has 2,000 products live. The numbers are crazy. The man himself is a ball of energy and clear thinking and also just razor sharp thinking as well. So I hope you enjoy this second part of the interview. We're going to talk about suppliers and Will's predictions for the future of Amazon and how to handle that. Now, let's talk about suppliers since you mentioned that. I mean, one of the big fears, as you said up front, is that, you know, oh, I'm going to get ripped off. I'm going to get sent a load of rubbish by my Chinese supplier. And as you say, I've seen like once in about 1,000 sort of talkings about suppliers that I've seen online. So what are your main tips for beginners on finding a suppliers, and what are the main do's and don'ts for working with them?
More times than not, it just think it through kind of rationally that like it doesn't, they're not going to be in business very long if they're just ripping everyone off once. It's a lot more profitable just to have a semi-decent product and sell to a supplier over and over again. It's just kind of common business sense. So that's like just not a long-term strategy for a lot of these suppliers. But for the most part, you can get a sourcing agent fairly cheap. You can get an inspection company. I was looking at like, I think it's like asiainspection.com. They do $100 inspections. And so it's like they'll go to the factory, make sure it's legit, make sure there's no children working there, there's no toxic chemicals, there's no safety hazards, all that kind of stuff. For $100, it's like that's a pretty good insurance policy to make sure nothing gets screwed up. And then from there, make sure they're kind of a gold supplier, all that kind of stuff. And more times than not, I've never really had a problem once where I got a bunch of rubbish or I got a bunch of products that didn't work or weren't as described.
Great.
And two, I'll have them kind of send me pictures as they go through the process of here's what the packaging's going to look like, here's what the product looks like. And more times than not, it's, you can kind of just see like the factory in the background. It's not like this like fancy picture. They're not like fooling me.
Yeah, makes sense. And what are the big other things? And so so you remove the fear very simply from that. So what are the big do's and don'ts about finding a supplier or choosing a supplier, should we say?
I just try to sell the simplest, easiest products possible for the most part whenever I can. So I like very minimal moving parts. I like very little electronics. I like mostly they're just different hunks of rubber, wood, plastic, that kind of thing, like cement drink coasters, like so just the simplest thing that cannot break. It's just normal where the supplier doesn't really matter that much because it's like too hard to mess up. I'm not selling private label tablets or something like that where I have to go to a million different suppliers to make sure I get the right quality and make sure that we get the right size and the right price. I'm usually just selling some really simple, dumb crap where it's not really, it's pretty hard for them to mess it up.
I like it. Make it so simple that a supplier can't mess it up.
Yeah, I just, like, more times than not, I just keep telling people, like, why are you making life so hard on yourself? Like, this can be easy. Like, why are you sitting there trying to, no, but I want to sell these robotic toys. It's like, why are you trying to, like, I get that you have some weird passion or something about it, but like, just make your life easy. Like, let's just, like, you ask, like, how to travel and work from your laptop. Well, it's sourcing stupid stuff. Like, it's not, it's like, for me, it's not rocket science. Don't try to do it the hardest way possible. Try to do it the easy way as possible.
That's such a great thing to hear. And actually, I have to say, I'm smiling here because I'm thinking like, I've got that tendency. I don't know why. I like complicated things. But when it comes to products, I'm convinced because I've made the mistake of sourcing electronic products. And of course, you know, famously, you get a ton of defects. And so it proved first time out, although it has improved. But yeah, I hear you. I definitely hear you. Now, any other do's and don'ts for working with suppliers? I mean, obviously, you're picking the best, simplest products. Any other ways to make it as well? Let's go with that. How do we make it as simple as possible?
Just try to think of every single thing that can go wrong with it. Try to think of every worst case scenario, and if you can't really think of any worst case scenarios, then it's usually a pretty good good thing to move forward with. One thing I do try to do is I like to sell needs, not wants, more times than not. Where if I sell a polka dot underwear, that's more of a want, where if I buy it for $2 and I see people selling it for $20, if I sell it for $5, there's a decent chance people still don't want to buy it because it's not, you can't liquidate it easily. But if I'm selling, say, a 10-inch bolt that everyone's selling for $12 and I can sell it for $8, if someone sees it for $8, they can't help but buy it because all the bolts look the same. And so it's a kind of a want, it's a need, not a want, because they're not sitting there going, oh, someday I'll buy this 12-inch bolt. It's like, no, I need this 12-inch bolt to fix my machinery. I'm going to order it now. That's the cheapest one. I'm buying it now. There's okay. No questions asked. So it's like when I can liquidate it, that's always kind of a good way to make sure that I don't have to take too big of a risk.
Okay. So in other words, liquidate it because it's a you know, sort of generic, what would you call it? It's a commodity almost, that you, if you need to get rid of it, you can, because there's a definite market for it.
Exactly. There's a market out there for people who just want the cheapest one possible. But okay. With underwear, polka dot underwear might be a weird keyword that the only reason people searched it because they wanted a specific brand of that.
Yeah. So how would you make sure that you're going to find a profitable product then? So if you're selling a 10-inch bolt for $8 instead of $12, how can you build some profit into that for yourself?
Well, it's the kind of thing where I would just look at it and I'd email the supplier saying, hey, how many does 1,000 cost? And they'd say, it's $1 a unit landed. And I go, okay, crunch the math real quick. Well, if I'm selling it for $8, I'm probably paying $3.60 in fees to $4.50 in fees plus the $1 product cost landed. So I'm still making $3 a pop. And so for every $1 I'm investing, I'm getting $3 back. That's a pretty good ratio.
That's amazing, Racer. Yeah. Okay. So I can begin to see how that works. Now, so this implies that you don't have a sort of criterion on price that, you know, you don't go below $20 or something like that. Do you have any price criteria, as in selling price?
No, it's more of a time spent to profit ratio. Okay. Where if I'm sitting there ordering 1,000 different types of bolts and I'm constantly managing it, having to talk to the supplier over and over again, and I'm only getting, say, like a 15% return after everything, then it's like, ooh, I'm spending all day on this like niche and I'm not getting that big of a return. Well, there's other products that I only have to reorder once every 3 months and they give me a 35% return. And so those are the kind of stuff I want to spend my time on. It's a time to profit ratio more than just a price point.
Wow. So again and again, it comes back to the whole cash flow thing, really, with you, it seems. Cash flow, like money over time.
Well, it's kind of thing where if I gave you $10 million right now, could you make me $2 million back within the next year?
Yeah. So you're thinking like an investor.
Yeah, it's like, of course you could. But it's like, if I gave you $500,000, could you make me $2 million back? It's like, no, probably not. Yeah. And so it just all comes down to cash. And so it's reinvesting it and getting it back as fast as possible so you can reinvest it and compound it again. You've obviously probably seen those examples of, if you do like whatever, invest $100 a day and have a 7% return a year kind of thing, in 30 years you have $1 million. And so the compounding interest is like the, whatever they say, like the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah.
And so you need to take advantage of it.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. It's very different thinking. As you said, exactly. It's very different thinking from what tends to go around the Amazon bubble. And but actually, funnily enough, there's a guy that I know who lives like next door who is an investor, and he's like 90. He's been investing for like 60 years. And that's exactly the sort of conversation I have with him when I talk about investing. That's very, very interesting indeed. Okay, so now let's come back to the sort of day-to-day experience of Amazon. And I suspect I'm going to get a similar answer to you from this, from the other things. But competition, how do you deal with increasing competition in Amazon private label? There's no doubt that partly because of all the other courses out there, there's lots of people entering the market. What's your strategy for dealing with that or avoiding
so
it?
As competition grows and the different products I have, I just cheat and then I sell my products directly to Amazon. And then Amazon outranks everyone and beats everyone out for the buy box.
Okay.
So I make a slightly lower profit margin, but then I get 100% of the sales most times.
Okay. So how does that work?
So there's two ways you can do it. There's Vendor Central and there's Vendor Express. So Vendor Express, anyone can sign up for. Vendor Central is like more times than not, it's invite only, but you can still apply to it. I just had one of my consulting clients get accepted to it. Basically, Amazon, you tell them, hey, I want to sell these products directly to you. If there's some sort of sales history, Amazon's interested more times than not. And then you offer up a price point to them. Amazon can choose to accept or deny it, but more times than not, they accept it if there's any profit to be made. Yeah. And then they'll start placing purchase orders. And so it's a little bit more annoying because you'll have to keep some inventory on hand. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, Amazon, if it's a branded product that you're competing for the buy box and competition's coming in that way, Amazon wins the buy box more times than not. Mm-hmm. And if it's a private label product, Amazon will just outrank everyone for that keyword if the competition's getting too much, as long as there's not other people selling to Amazon in that same niche. So I sell to Amazon as selling on Amazon.
Wow, so that's a radical way. So is that open to pretty much anyone? You were saying about the...
Vendor Express is open to everyone.
Vendor Express. So how do you actually apply for that? Is that on Amazon Seller Central somewhere, or do you just email in?
Vendor Central. So yeah, just type in Google Vendor Express and then do sign up.
Great. Wow, interesting. So that's what you do, presumably, when you get to the point where the private labeling route is not going to be viable anymore for profit.
Yep.
Okay, so that's like a product's kind of got killed off by a price war, effectively.
More times than not, it's not a price war. It's like, I'm usually don't go into it unless I can be like one of the lower prices. It's just that someone will come in and actually like care about their listing and give away 200 and get a very high ranking, where it's like, crap, like I've just been doing rinse and repeat, not really even paying attention to this listing. I see the sales start going down. I go, oh, look, there's three new private label people in that niche, and they're actually doing a good job like optimizing the listing and caring about it. I'm just going to sell to Amazon and then outrank them again.
Okay. So basically you don't want to enter into the same thing they're doing, like giveaways and optimizing your listing, all that stuff.
No, because I got too many SKUs to manage. I don't have time to. Usually I'll look at their storefront and they'll have three listings total. And it's like, yeah, when I have 2,000 and then selling to Amazon up to 10,000, it's like I don't have time to sit there and optimize the listing and watch it like a hawk like they do.
Right. No, that would make sense. So you got 2,000 listings, did you say? Or something like that. Wow. So that brings us to the next obvious question, which is going to be for the more ambitious amongst us who are scaling up fast. How do you manage 2,000 listings?
Well, more times, if I had 2,000 suppliers, it'd be impossible.
Yeah.
But I have like 20 suppliers.
Yeah.
And so managing it is not that terrible, because you use software like Stitch Labs and Restock Pro, and basically it kind of gets automated, and they just send me like an alert saying, hey, looking at your sales history, looking at your lead times you've entered in, you need to order X amount of products. And once I see it kind of build up big enough for one supplier, I'll order that product. And it's something that'd be very, very hard to train someone to do my position, since I'm kind of so ingrained in it. I need to do a better job of systemizing it. But for the most part, I know which suppliers have short lead times, which one have long lead times, where I'm at with them, which containers on the way. It's kind of all these things I just kind of keep track of in the back of my mind for the most part. It's not the end of the world to try to manage it. And then if I need to ever second check anything, the software kind of backs up my suspicions.
You're kind of playing a sort of mental chess game. That reminds me of that. I knew some guy at school who could play like 6 chess games at the same time and beat everyone without looking like he was thinking. So you're kind of playing like a mental chess game in the back of your mind with where your containers are on the sea and where your suppliers are at. Is it literally in your head, or is that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the software the software will tell me what's on its way,
right,
and what's in stock and what needs to be ordered. So it's like, there's always that kind of in the back, but I just don't need to actually check it, because I go, okay, is this supplier? Oh yeah, I just went to the bank yesterday and wrote them a check. Okay, well that's pretty easy to remember. Oh, is this supplier? Yep, I remember that came in 2 weeks ago. And usually that takes like 6 weeks to sell out, so I don't even have to worry about that for another month. Is this supplier okay? Yep, they look in stock. Is this supplier okay? Yep, they're in stock. And it's like, I can do that checklist real quick, just going down them in 20 minutes.
Okay, so you're checking by supplier rather than product, because you've only got 20 suppliers to deal with.
Yeah, and and when you're ordering, say you have a supplier that has, you're ordering 100 different SKUs from them, you only need to order 50 units of each to fill up a container.
Okay. Yeah, so in other words, you can get the economies of scale and the lower shipping costs, but actually you're not risking a lot per SKU.
Exactly.
You're not tying the cash. Again, it's like cash flow, because you're turning that cash around quickly.
Yeah, cash flow is everything.
Man, this is the theme that's coming out again and again. So what are your predictions for the future? Because obviously you're already seeing things like Amazon moving in, and basically you're selling your inventory, or presumably you sell your inventory rather than like your entire sort of brand to Amazon. With the Vendor Express and the Vendor Central. So how do you see that going with private label and the relationship between private labelers and Amazon going forward over the next year or two?
So the next year or two, I think it's just going to keep being just growing, because competition is growing, but more times than not, I'm seeing all the competition is pretty dumb. They're kind of just selling the same stuff and doing the same crap. And it's like, if I'm a thought leader in the category and people are listening to my advice, then it's pretty easy to stay ahead because I can just not tell everyone everything.
Right.
And so it's like not that hard. I can just tell everyone to zig and I'll go zig. So yeah, I'm not too worried for competition in the next couple of years, but next like 5 to 10 years, anything that's like a semi-commodity, China is just going to sell it directly to Amazon. Amazon's opening up warehouse offices in like Guangzhou and Shenzhen and holding seminars in Shenzhen for people to learn how to sell on Amazon and stuff. So like anything that's a commodity, China's going to be selling it directly to Amazon fairly soon. And so you're going to have to stay in these kind of low competition niches and fly below the radar so no one bugs you.
Okay, so what sort of commodity products would that be, for example?
Basically everything in like the top 100 BSR that's not like a real US brand name.
Okay, great. So anything where people just, again, it's shopping on needs, not wants, basically. Like yeah, if they need to buy like a bolt or something.
Yeah, if someone can sell you a spatula for $2.99 and all the private labelers need to sell it at $9.99 to break even, you're going to buy the $2.99 one, especially if it has 10,000 reviews since everyone's buying it over and over again. And especially too, if it's sold by Amazon. Like the Amazon basics category is only going to get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So how do you see yourself dealing with all this stuff from your position? And then I better ask about people who are in a slightly more humble position. 2,000 product lines is quite incredible. So, how are you going to be placing yourself to deal with this increased competition and change of approach from Amazon?
Well, again, with me diversifying over a bunch of SKUs, and these brands, me selling a lot of U.S. brands, that they do their own marketing, product research, and sourcing. So I kind of depend on them to keep growing their businesses. But at the same time, if you have 4 SKUs total and one of them gets deranked because a bunch of Chinese sellers come in, you lose a quarter of your revenue. Where me, to lose a quarter of my revenue, 500 of my listings aren't going to go belly up overnight.
No.
You know? So it's like I'm diversifying my risk, and it's like for me, I can see stuff coming from a mile away where it's like, okay, this product starts dropping, then this product starts dropping, then this product starts dropping, and it would be like one product a week. And it's like when I got this many SKUs, it's a lot easier to see it coming and kind of make a change and pivot opposed to when you only have a few listings.
Okay, so one of the things apart from cash flow management is really get out and diversify your SKUs as quick as you can.
Yeah, kind of just, it sounds so silly, but it's just, yeah, it comes back to kind of investing things. So diversify and get cash flow.
Yeah, so it's basically investment principles more than any sort of hot-headed entrepreneurial or, like you say, the sexy building a brand thing.
Yeah, I've never really thought of it that way, but the more I kind of think out loud right now, yes.
Interesting. Oh my God. So how can people who are starting out take advantage of that way of thinking? Is it just get launched as quick as you can? What would your sort of, I know, 3 or 4 step basic launch advice be?
Again, this is why I was kind of poo-pooing on the courses earlier, where it's so not one size fits all, where if you have $500 to invest, I would start trying to flip stuff from AliExpress or try to drop ship or do something like that, or get a second job and save up more cash. But if you have like $50,000 to invest, you can actually start calling up these wholesalers right off the bat and say, hey, I got $10,000 order ready to be placed. Can I place it right now with you? And so it's like, if you give me a bunch of different examples of starting with $500 or $5,000 or $50,000, I can kind of give you an idea, but an overarching strategy doesn't really work too much.
That makes great sense. Okay, so you've told what a $500 savings person would do. And by the way, thank you for some common sense. Like sometimes people say, I've got £500 to invest in Amazon. I'm like, well, go and get some more money then and come back.
Using mine too. It's like, well, go get a second job.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, don't why jump through great big hoops to get another £500 or you know, $1,500? I mean, just do something simple. You know, do some more consulting. You know, do more of your day job. Do, you know, get an extra job for a couple of months.
That's my always advice is, find a successful Amazon seller and see if you can work for them for $15 an hour or something like that, because they'd love to probably have an employee who actually knows how Amazon works, and then you get kind of on-the-job training where you can make some extra cash and learn more and more about Amazon. It's a win-win.
That makes total sense. That's an extremely good idea. And what about if you got, say, $5,000 to invest then? Because you were saying $5,000,
$50,000. Yeah, $5,000 is like right on that border, because like $10,000 is a decent amount of money. $5,000 is not a ton. $5,000, I don't think it's enough to order from China. Right. It's going to be hard to order $2,500 worth of stuff because you're going to want to keep that much cash liquid too. Half of the cash liquid, as I mentioned earlier.
Excellent.
I'm trying to think, like, maybe you could find a small enough retailer, or you could do some retail arbitrage, or try to sign up a wholesaler who will allow you to drop ship their larger products. Say, call up a fireplace manufacturer and say, hey, do you guys drop ship? And they go, yeah, of course we do. Like, more customers not prefer drop shipping. And so, like, you got to go for the bigger, bulkier stuff if you're going to drop ship. But do something like that, because $5,000 is right at that limit where it's a decent chunk of cash, but it's not enough really to start a business. And it's kind of one of these things where, would you start a restaurant with $5,000? Would you start any other business with $5,000? It's like, it's kind of a, like, we're in a very lucky spot where it's actually possible to start a business with such a small amount of cash.
Yeah. What about if you have, say, $10,000, then as you said, that's more.
Then you can actually order from China, because a $5,000 order will actually kind of get you somewhere. And so then that's when you can start maybe private labeling, or find a smaller mom and pop shop that does only, say, a little bit under $10 million a year in revenue.
Okay. So you place a $5,000 into the order and then retain the rest for what, advertising, and above all for restocking.
Basically. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Okay. So what if you have, so if you're on that, because I think quite a lot of people would be around that sort of $5,000 mark when they wanted to start. I don't know why that figure keeps coming up, about £3,000. What would you do in that situation?
Yeah, $5,000 comes up all the time. That's like the amount people tell me they have to invest. I tell them, basically, if you can order something off AliExpress that's profitable, go there first, because the lead times are so much quicker. You can get a product in your hands in 10 days instead of going 10 days back and forth negotiating because of the time zone difference, because you're getting one email off a day kind of thing. So try to use AliExpress because of the short lead times. If you're not finding something profitable, but you find something profitable on Alibaba, then see if you can air freight it and see if it's still profitable at that point. And basically that's all you can do, is just kind of place these small orders. It's still not a ton of money. It's unfortunate, because $5,000 is nothing to mess around with, but at the same time, it's not, no Chinese supplier is going to bend over backwards for you for that same amount of money.
I have to say that I've started off with orders of, say, what I put in, say, about $3,000 or something, and you can get air freighted orders for that, and you won't get special treatment, but it can be moderately profitable for a time if you choose the right niche.
Yep.
And then after a while, it's so easy to get into, then everyone else would do the same. So then you need to change strategy.
Exactly. But it's kind of thing where if you can invest $3,000 to make $700 back after, say, a month or so, that is a very good starting point. It might not seem like you're making a ton of money, but at the same time, you realize that as you order more, the profit margin is only going to get bigger over time. It's the rich get richer with Amazon. The more you sell, the higher you rank. The more you sell, the more you can buy. So the price gets lower, so your profit margin gets bigger. So as you grow, it's only going to get easier.
Yeah. Now, I have to say that I'm about to sort of launch myself, which may sound a bit pathetic for somebody who does sea freight, you know, by the container load. But I'm about to launch myself at my first sea freight for products, because I'm realizing that obviously the profit's often when you buy, not when you sell. And if you're buying through air freight, it's a good way of testing a market, but, you know, it doesn't leave a lot of profit after a while.
Yeah, and an interesting thing too to think about as you people sit there and try to optimize their listings and try to negotiate. It is beneficial, but it gets, once you get bigger and bigger, it becomes like crucial, because if I, at $10 million a year mark, if I can increase profit by 1%, that's an extra $100,000 in my pocket. And if I have a 20% margin, I have to sell another $500,000 worth of product. It's a lot easier to save an extra 1% margin than to sell an extra $500,000 worth of stuff a year.
Okay, so it's easier to save 1% than it is to sell whatever, a huge amount.
Yeah, exactly. So I would try to sell as much as possible in the beginning, but there is a point where you're going to have to look and say, hey, if I can squeeze that extra 1% out or 2% out doing sea freight instead of air freight, it actually is going to make me a lot more money over time.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's all the questions that come to mind. I love the frankness and like the straight up approach, like it's cash flows, everything, which is something that hardly anyone else I've ever heard talks about. So that's really good to hear. What parting advice would you have? And before we say that, we ought to say, how do people find more about you?
You can find me on Twitter at WTJERN. My email is my name, williamchurnland@gmail.com. Email me if you have any questions. Facebook/Churnland is my Facebook if you guys want to be friends. Just, yeah, contact me anyway if you guys have any questions.
What is your passing advice for somebody who's just wanting to get started in this entire business at Amazon, private labeling, or possibly even wholesale?
Don't go after what you're passionate about. Just go where the cash flow is, and don't be scared to make a mistake. Kind of just move forward, and more times than not, you can liquidate it and get your money back. So just don't be scared and move forward.
Excellent. Sounds like fantastic advice. Will, it's been a huge pleasure. As Danny warned me, you are machine gunning information. You're a powerhouse of information. So it's been incredibly enlightening and thought-provoking. So thank you very, very much for your time, Will.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Wow, ladies and gentlemen, that was the powerhouse that is Will Churnland. What an amazing thinker. I just love the clarity of thought, the depth of thought, and yet the simplicity of the approach, basically. He's stripping it down to the essentials, despite the fact that he's got very sophisticated strategies and massive number of SKUs. I mean, 2,000 product lines. I thought having 12 was problematic at one point. But so Will has a few real gold nuggets that I think we need to take away now. I know it's tempting to say, well, look at what he does. He's got lots of money. He has a big warehouse. You know, he's working on a different level and some different strategies, using wholesale, whatever. But I think that is missing the point. I think everyone, including myself, but also including anyone who's just starting out, can really, really learn from Will. Above all, the basic principles of business that he has absolutely got taped. So let's look at what he has to say. This is a quick revision. Cash flow is everything. And I really love that clarity of thought. Nobody I've ever heard talk about anything in Amazon has ever talked about cash flow, ever. Don't know why, because it's the number one responsibility of any entrepreneur. And an entrepreneur whose name escapes me, Felix somebody, who was a legitimate multi-mega rich person, he had worth about 800 million or something, said, look, you know, as an entrepreneur, your accountant can worry about amortization and stuff, and you can gradually come and learn stuff about that. But cash flow is your responsibility from the beginning. So that totally ties in with what Will was saying. I love also the clarity of getting return on cash. He's got a very simple aim, which is get a return on cash as fast as possible. Specifically, he's looking to make about 20% back within a couple of months. For example, you spend $3,000 now and you make $3,700 in 2 months, which is about a 20% return. And he also thinks in terms of time to profit more than minimum maximum price. But that doesn't mean that we can't, for example, have the simple price criterion like between $20 and $50 and also think about how quickly you get your money back. But again, it's focused on cash flow more than profit and loss is some abstract thing. Again, some great keys about product selection. Very simple things, but very, very wise. Keep it simple. Don't do complex toys or electronics. Make sure it's hard to break. And I love this, really, Murphy's Law application. Think of everything that can go wrong. If you can't think of anything, that's a good choice. I mean, how simple is that? And yet, how many of us have done that? I've certainly gone straight smack bang into the electronics thing and regretted it deeply. So that is something I can totally tell you from experience. That is so true. Keep it simple. The Chinese will be good at messing up the simple unless you keep it very simple. Again, the questions, the marketing type questions, you know, product choice. How will you get on number one, or so to say, on page one? And again, how will you stand out on page one? What will make your customers buy your product over someone else's? Again, excellent, dead simple questions. But if you can't answer those, don't move forward with the product. And again, very simple. This is not something that is reserved for the rich. In fact, that's why he's rich, or, you know, getting there. And then the other thing, simple thing that I took away is cash flow management. Only ever invest half of your total capital in stock at any one time. Makes total sense. And again, sadly, I can say from experience how important that is, because otherwise you'll make more sales than you were expecting. And then suddenly you're out of stock for quite a long time because you've had to wait for the cash to come back in before you can then go restock. Meantime, you are out of stock for a month, 2 months, and everyone else piles in and Amazon hates you. So those things alone really are worth going and really, really absorbing and taking on board properly. So as ever, I think with this, it's like the learn bit of it, the learn, do, review. Holy trilogy still stands, but I really think that with Will, it does pay a bit of absorbing, because it's pretty hard stuff to grasp in the first instance, because it is less tactical and do this, just do this. It's big principle thinking, big picture thinking. But I really do think that it's really, really worth it. So
learn this stuff. Go look at the show notes. I really urge you to do that. It's up to you how much time you have to spend. If you're going to spend time on anything in Amazon, rather than looking what the small fish are saying to each other, or, you know, somebody like me who's running a podcast, but, you know, go and look at what Will Churnland and Greg Mercer and people like that are doing. Another person we've got coming up who I really am looking forward to speaking to, Anthony Lee, who is going to be interviewed in the next couple of weeks here. And he is somebody that Will Churnland was saying to me privately after the interview had finished, that he really respects him and he's got quite a different take on things, but they also, you know, have serious conversations over in Canton Fair. And really, you know, if somebody like Will Churnland is taking somebody seriously, then they are really worth taking seriously. So Anthony is coming up. We've also got Manuel Beckvar coming up. Manuel's a really expert in the whole sourcing business. He's been out in Hong Kong for 15 years, as well as Peter Zapf. He's an Austrian and he specializes in electronics. So he's got another take on the whole supply chain thing. And especially if you are going to go into electronics, which despite Will's warnings, you might be tempted. Take it from me, you do not want to go in without really knowing what you're doing in terms of quality control specifically. So if you are going to go into that, then Manuel is going to be your lifesaver. So listen out for those things, folks. It's all coming. It's all to play for, and I am bringing you these genius people at no cost to you, but it would be lovely to have a review and to remind you of the importance of reviews. I'm going to hand over to our friend John Lee Dumas of Entrepreneur on Fire.
Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of EO Fire, and you're listening to Amazing FBA with the marvelous Michael Veazey. The place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. You must be prepared to ignite.
Thanks so much to John there for the fantastic audio bumper. Lots of fun. I like the razzmatazz. And if you wish to have something good happen to you in return for a review, then you can right here, right now. So all you need to do is go to www.amazingfba.com/iTunes review, or just go to the blog, www.amazingfba.com. And look in the menu bar for how to leave an iTunes review. Either way, you should get that information. Then go to iTunes, leave your review, and then please do a screenshot of it. And you can email that to me along with a question and I will answer it in depth. I normally only do email support these days for my mentees because I can't take the time to support everybody else. Other than that, you can always get your questions answered over at the Facebook group www.amazingfba.com. We have at the time of recording 296 members. So by the time you hear this, it's probably just gone over 300, which is a great sweet spot. It's big enough to have some action going on, but small enough so that you're not going to be swamped in information and digging through hundreds of posts just to find something simple. So get yourselves over there, guys. Meantime, learn, do review. Really go and learn from all these amazing people I'm getting in on the podcast. Very lucky to have made contacts and got to know some wonderful people, but it does take me time and effort. And if you put the time and effort in to absorb what they have to say, and by all means, go listen to other podcasts, go and listen for the Will Churnland interviews. I would personally go and find everything that Greg Mercer said, everything that Will Churnland has said, because these guys are powerhouses. And if you listen and you really, really listen to what they're doing, rather than just kind of superficially, then you will learn so much great stuff that over time, if you absorb stuff like this, you don't just listen to it once, you absorb it, you listen multiple times, you listen with taking notes, you read the show notes, you make your own summary, you implement this stuff, I swear you will just be a better business person. There is no other way it can happen. Right, enough from me. Go do stuff, guys. Speak to you in the next podcast. Have fun. Bye-bye.